Hi, Al.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright of Blogging Heads TV. You are Al Press, well-known writer. We've seen your work in The Nation, New York Times Magazine, New York Review of Books, and so on. And now, what I believe is your first book is out, right?
It's actually my second
It's your
book.
second book.
It is.
Well, then I'll bet I can guess the name of the first book.
It
Was it called Absolute Convictions?
is. That's it was.
You know, I just had a sense. I just had a sense. It was really weird, but I got it right.
Amazing.
So your second book, it's called
Yes.
Beautiful Souls.
That's it.
Subtitle is Saying No, Breaking Ranks, and Heeding the Voice of Conscience in Dark Times. And it's a book about, it's kind of four case studies of people who defied social pressure to do what they considered the right thing. In three of the cases, doing the right thing involved crossing ethnic lines. So you had, in World War II, you had a Swiss Christian helping German Jews. You had, during the Yugoslavian Civil War, you had a Serb helping Croatian men. And then you have an Israeli soldier standing up for Palestinian rights. Then the fourth case is actually more of a whistleblower case, corporate whistleblower. So I want to talk about all those, talk about what they do or don't have in common. But first, I would like you to tell us what the origin of the title Beautiful Souls is. Expression, right?
Yes, it does. Beautiful souls in Hebrew is yafei nefesh. In English, the phrase sounds like a compliment. We hear that and we think, boy, I would love to be thought of as a beautiful soul. But in Hebrew and in Israel today, most soldiers in particular do not like to be thought of and called beautiful souls. The phrase, in a sense, connotes being a bleeding heart, being too pure and too,
Kind of naive.
yes, and naive. And it is the title of the book because, as you said, one of the characters in the book is an Israeli soldier who is in the top unit of the Israeli army for 3.5 years and then goes through an awakening where he becomes increasingly disillusioned. To the point that he tells his commander he will not serve in the occupied territories. Not that he won't serve at all, he actually continues serving in the army, but not in the occupied territories. And as he went through that awakening, he told me that there was a moment where he wanted to tell the other soldiers, you know, I'm not a beautiful soul. I'm not that. I'm just someone who, I'm just like you. But I cannot square the ideals that we've been taught about what the army stands for with what I see going on in the occupied territories. And I was really struck by both his use of that phrase, again, in this kind of negative way, this way of not wanting to be associated with it. And I also thought, and I think, that it's the right title for the book because the truth of the matter is, we only think of these people who question and say no and go against the grain as beautiful, if you will, as admirable in every respect, when we're very far away from them. And when what they did was question, say, another government or another society's common norms and values, when they're our own norms and values or our own government, it's almost inevitably the case that there's a more complicated perception of that person. It can be straight up negative, that is, this person's a traitor. Or it's, well, yeah, there's something to this, but this guy's really a purist and it's kind of naive. So I felt it was the right title for this book because in every case, the person is really not thought of as this kind of noble, virtuous person.
And they are different. They are psychologically different. I mean, before we get into the individual cases, is there any, you know, when you look at the source of their moral courage, is there even anything that they all had in common?
There are two things that they all have in common, and when I go into the specifics of the cases, it will be easier to bring out these two things. But one of these things, which is in a sense counterintuitive, is that they are all, I would almost say, rebels in spite of themselves, or nonconformists in spite of themselves. That is, they're very by-the-book, idealistic, team players, insiders who really believe in the system they're in, whether that system is the Israeli army, whether that system is, in the case of the American character, the company she works for in the financial industry, whether in the case of the Swiss police captain, it's the national ideals that are supposed to guide him. In each of the cases in the book, you do not find people who ever expected they would be the ones to blow the whistle or rebel or speak out. And yet I think that's part of the reason they spoke out. That is, it's not an accident that they're, in a sense, these true believers in these ideals. That's one thing. The second thing is that each of the characters, as you mentioned, there is a theme of sort of going against or crossing kind of ethnic or national division in three of the four stories. But in all of the cases, I think that what these characters do is engage in an act of imaginative resistance. That is, they need to somehow, and they come to a point of somehow imagining another either immigrants or enemies in a war or someone else that is supposed to be the enemy or is supposed to be written out of the circle of concern and compassion that becomes included in that circle for them. And so there's this act of kind of leaping across an imaginative border that each of them engages in, which is why some of the book is about empathy and what we know about empathy now and how it works and how it doesn't work and so forth.
I'm trying to think whether in all three of the cases of kind of crossing an ethnic line, the person had some prior connection with people on the other side of the line. I know that was the case in some of them, but was it really the case in all? Did the Swiss captain German Jews or even Jews personally?
Here's the where this comes into play with the Swiss police captain. He is, in 1938, given this mandate from the Swiss government to prevent actually Austrian refugees, but Austria then had been annexed by Nazi Germany. So effectively, people fleeing the Nazis from crossing into Switzerland. The Swiss government passes a restriction that says, you should not let these people in. Now, no, he did not know these people personally. He did not have some kind of personal link. But he did make what the authorities came to look at as a big mistake. And the big mistake was that this guy was the captain of the police in an area of Switzerland that bordered Austria. Instead of delegating this task to someone below him in the chain of command, he ended up doing it himself. He let refugees come directly to his office, to the Swiss police headquarters in St. Gallen, the city where he lived. He went to the border directly. He saw them. He interacted with these refugees. And what he told his daughter, who I interviewed when I went to Switzerland to tell the story, he told her, look, when I saw the faces of these people, I could not do anything else. And of course, we know he could have done something else. So I take that with a grain of salt. There certainly were other choices he could have made. But one of the themes of the book, and it comes up in each of the stories, is that proximity and direct contact do make a difference in terms of the ability to kind of go along with malevolent orders or with what we would consider unjust laws. So here is this guy sitting in St. Gallen. Suppose he delegated the task to someone else and never saw the faces of these refugees, never heard their stories. We know from both history and scientific experiments that it would have been much easier for him to go along. And one of the reasons we know this, and I tell this story in the book, we can look no further than the famous experiment Stanley Milgram did here in the United States, where he took a cross-section of residents of Connecticut, brought them to a lab at Yale, and said, we're going to do a learning experiment. One person will teach, one person will learn. Of course, it was a rigged experiment. The learner was an actor. And Milgram had people, every time the learner answered a question wrong, the teacher had to turn the voltage up one notch on a shock machine.
They thought they were actually administering a shock, even though they weren't.
They weren't. The actor would pretend to be shocked. And Milgram figured only a few people would go along with this all the way. The startling thing was that two-thirds of the people in the experiment ended up going along. But the interesting thing is that if you actually read the transcripts and look at what transpired in the labs. They tried to stop. Most people didn't want to go along. And Milgram would tell them, well, look, the responsibility is not yours, it's mine, you have to go along. He had certain prods that would get them to go along. Now, he then changed one vital thing. He took the person, the learner, in the initial experiment was behind a glass panel in a separate room, and he put that person in the same room as the person, as the teacher, and the rate of disobedience doubled. And so what Milgram observed was, you know, proximity to the victim, in a sense of the shock, has a direct bearing on how able people were to no longer to resist. And we see that there are other stories in the book that kind of illustrate the same point.
Okay. So the Swiss police captain, his name was Paul Gruninger, and for his services he was disciplined. He wasn't put in jail, but he was fined, I think, and I guess maybe drummed out of the Corps. Later vindicated, I guess, in the 70s, in the 1970s, his heroism was acknowledged. Say a little bit about the Serbian guy, who's an interesting case study in what can go into this sort of moral courage.
Well, the Serbian character who it was a challenge to find him, and what he did was so remarkable that it made me think of him in a certain way. His name is Aleksandar Jevtic. He goes by the nickname Acho. And he was a Serb from the city of Vukovar, which in 1991 was sort of a contested city, and there was a war between Croatia and Serbia as Yugoslavia fell apart. Now, Aleksandar Jevtic ends up being trapped in the city, and when it is finally conquered and taken over by the Serbs, they take men in the town to a detention camp in Serbia, and he's one of these men in a bus along with all these other prisoners of war. The problem for the Serbs running the detention camp was that they could not tell who was who among the prisoners. They knew that some of the prisoners were actually Serbs, just like them, that they weren't all Croats. And the conditions in the camp were terrible. People were getting abused. People were getting beaten. Some people were being taken outside for questioning and getting shot. One of the guards recognizes Aleksandar Jevtic and says, "Oh, Acho, I remember you. You're one of us. Can you help us pick out the Serbs among these prisoners so they can be taken to a separate room and not abused?" And he proceeds to do so, so to speak, but he actually tricks the guards. He starts calling people by fake Serbian names, kicking at the feet of Croatians, of Croats who are in this prison. At first, they're kind of shocked. They don't know what's going on. They think, is this some kind of, you know, what's with this guy? Until they realize he's actually trying to help. And he fills this room with Croats until there's no more space. When I heard this story, I have to admit that I pictured Aleksandar Jevtic as a kind of, an intellectual, someone who had a firm, well-established critique of ethnic nationalism and war, maybe a pacifist. It turns out that this guy was in a very stereotypical way, a kind of regular guy. Like, you know, he likes to watch TV. He likes sports. He didn't finish high school. I visited his apartment. There were no books in the apartment. There was a big television that he sort of set up in his living room. His story kind of begged the question, well, you know, what is it that got him to do this? If it wasn't the sort of pre-established critique of nationalism that I had expected. And what he said was, you know, I mean, there certainly is in his upbringing, from his parents, he was raised in a kind of to believe that ethnic differences and the differences between Croats and Serbs shouldn't matter, that he was, in a sense, they were all Yugoslavs. But there were a lot of people in Yugoslavia that were raised that way and that didn't act the way he did. He eventually told me, look, it was a gut impulse. I looked at the people in this prison. I saw the fear in their eyes, and I just decided to help them. And what his story tells us is that sometimes the best impulses are not really the ones that, that have to be learned or that are drawn from sophisticated theories, but rather are sort of forged through the crucible of experience. Here he is, a guy faced with a moral dilemma, faced with the suffering of others, and he does what's right, and at enormous risk to himself. In a sense, if he had thought too much about it, I realized afterwards, he might not have done this, because, of course, the risks were so great.
Now, there's something else that's interesting about him, which I think goes into his this act of courage, which is that, you may not want to put it quite this way, he's a little bit of a jerk, in the sense that, you know, he just doesn't care that much about, I mean, ironically, there are kinds of obligations he doesn't care about fulfilling, right? I mean, like, you had arranged to meet the guy, and he, like, oversleeps, and far from being apologetic, when you finally get a hold of him, he's like, let's do this some other time, even though you have traveled some distance to do it. And, you know, he's one of these people who just doesn't care a lot what other people think of him. And I think you kind of conclude that that can be an ingredient in indifference to peer pressure, obviously, can help you defy it. So sometimes being the kind of person who is actually a little bit of an annoyance in day-to-day life allows you to do great things, right?
That's very well put, and absolutely the case. I have to say that I didn't find this the most becoming trait, particularly when, you know, I had set up this interview. I thought that I was going to be spending a weekend with Acho, and had arranged to kind of to meet members of his family, his son, and so forth. And yes, he overslept. He basically said, "Can you come back another time?" And what I gradually realized was that, you know, this wasn't just about me. I took it personally at first, but it wasn't personal. It was that he really did go through life with this kind of inner-directed sense. That is, he looked in the mirror, he was at peace with himself, and that was enough. And actually, in the town of Vukovar, when I was there in 2008, it was a very good thing that he was like this, because the town was still very divided. And the Serbs in the town didn't quite accept him, because they knew he had done this thing. He had, in a sense, crossed the lines. And they didn't like him for that. The Croats, also, many Croats didn't like him because he was a Serb. So he was kind of this island in this town. And yet he went about as though, you know, it was not a problem. And I do think that that general trait, a kind of a certain amount of inner directedness or even callousness towards the kind of opinions of your peers, you know, an indifference to some extent, can serve you very well in an atmosphere like that.
And it reminds me of a part of the first case study, the one involving this Swiss police captain named Kooninger, I guess. It's not necessarily the case that the police who were enforcing the rules and turning away Jews at the border were anti-Semitic. Some of them felt strongly about, you know, keeping the rules going. And you even have this quote from, I think, Richard Holbrooke, right? It says, "Government service is based on the well-founded principle that officials must carry out their instructions. Otherwise, anarchy would prevail." And, you know, there is, the Serb, you know, might not be a very efficient worker. You know, he might not be contributing to the harmonious operation of everyday life for everyone around him. And yet, you know, the flip side of that is a good thing. But I guess, I mean, do you agree that it actually is a difficult choice, the one that Holbrooke is kind of alluding to here, that, you know, there is... You know, if everyone wanted to kind of follow their own gyroscope every time they had any kind of qualm about what their company was doing or whatever, you know, society might well grind to a halt, right? So it is a kind of a difficult thing.
I think you raise a really important point, and I want to get back. Later, maybe we can discuss what happens to society if no one does that, because I think there's an equal danger, if not a greater danger, that is that no one, in a sense, follows their inner gyroscope. But you're right, that I put that quote in there, and other quotes, to underscore that in each of the cases in this book, and really in any act of conscience, there is an obligation being fulfilled, and there is an obligation being broken, right? So it's not that this is, we should not think these are conflict-free choices. These choices always create conflicts. There's always some violation, if you will. Gruninger violated Swiss law. He happened to violate a law that most Swiss citizens today look back on with shame. But there's no disputing the fact.
Although the law itself was generic in the sense that it was about not letting in undocumented immigrants, basically. Right? Is that right? I mean, it was not a...
It was generic, but there were explicit things said that made it clear this was about keeping Jews out. And indeed, the Swiss even... ended up recommending something that the Germans took up, which was stamping the passports of Jews in Austria and Germany with a J. And this was one way that they signaled, okay, this person should not be let in. And there was open discussion at the time in Switzerland of the threat of what they called Jewification. So there definitely was an element of anti-Semitism, a specific concern about Jews. On the other hand, there was also concern that, Switzerland didn't want, it was a small country in a situation where there was economic difficulties, there were other security concerns, how many immigrants should be allowed in. And of course, the people who went along with this were not, as you say, all, sort of ardently anti-Semitic and certainly not pro-German in doing this. On the other hand, to get back to your question of what happens when everyone follows their gyroscope, that actually comes up most explicitly in the chapter in the book about Israel, because I do tell this story about, as I mentioned, a very patriotic, decorated soldier who becomes a refusenik and doesn't want to serve in the occupied territories. But I also tell the story and point out that in Israel today, the term refusnik used to refer in Israel to soldiers from the left, to liberal and leftist soldiers who became disillusioned with the occupation and said, I will not serve out of concern for peace, for the mistreatment of Palestinians, and so forth. Today in Israel, there are just as many soldiers disobeying orders on the right, and I tell some of their stories. And what kind of orders are they disobeying? Well, these are religious soldiers from the national religious camp politically, often educated in yeshivas, and they will not follow orders to remove settlers from buildings they've taken over or sometimes from hilltops that they've decided to settle without authorization.
And they think of themselves as following God's law.
That's right.
Over the state's law, which probably many, many Americans would endorse as a principle.
Well, in their understanding of conscience, yes, they're in a sense doing what if we go back and think, well, what is conscience? For centuries, conscience was simply the voice of conscience was thought to be the voice of God. So they would say to you, this is the classic illustration of an act of conscience. Now, in the book, I make it very clear that I think the moral difference between disobeying an order not to serve in an occupation that much of the world sees as illegal and disobeying an order not to, in a sense, abet and aid settlers in further cementing that occupation, that the moral difference between those two, to me, is very clear. But there is a problem here, which is that from the army's perspective, they will say to you, well, okay, you may think that, but if we allow one form of disobedience, what do we say to the other form of disobedience? And how is any kind of faith in the sort of notion that the army issues, that certain orders are issued and they will be followed, how can that be maintained? And some people on the Israeli left actually don't support refusal, individual acts of refusal, because they believe the army will be needed to dismantle the settlements one day. And when that day comes, they don't want people on the right to be able to say, wait a minute, you introduced this concept that we can just follow our conscience. Why can't we do that now?
But by that time, that it may be the positive scenario where they just refuse to help remove the settlers. The nightmare scenario some years from now may be that they actually take up arms on behalf of the settlers, the way things are going. But so you're saying there are now more refuseniks on the right than on the left. I didn't realize that.
I don't know about the numbers. I know that in terms of if you look at the ones making the most noise and causing the most concern in the upper ranks of the Israeli, among some senior Israeli officers, you will find that, and indeed I've written about this and reported on it in the New York Review of Books, that that indeed the incidents of soldiers on the right saying they will not follow orders to dismantle settlements have gone up markedly. So you ask a good question. On the other hand, I do think we should get back to the opposite concern, which is what happens in a society when no one listens to that inner gyroscope. That is, when all of us, in a sense, are good, peer pressure responding conformists. And there, I think, both in situations of war and in situations of peace, we find that social calamities and all kinds of problems will arise if no one speaks out.
Okay, so talk a little about the corporate whistleblower. This is the Stanford Group, whatever, it's a securities firm, it's a finance firm, that read about a little in the papers.
Yes, yes, a little bit, especially recently. In fact, the head of Stanford, Alan Stanford, was recently indicted, found guilty of, I can't remember the number of charges, but the story I tell is of the days not so long ago when Stanford had a glowing reputation in Houston. And I tell the story of a broker named Layla Weiger, who was hired at the company in the fall of 2000. For her, it was a kind of dream job. This is a woman who, originally from El Salvador, had gone through a difficult divorce, had two children she was supporting on her own, had been really at rope's end financially and in other ways. She trained herself, put herself through school, got her licenses, and then lands this job at Stanford with a $150,000 bonus. She starts working there. And then she starts getting the pressure that everyone else at the firm got to sell these certificates of deposit at Stanford's affiliated offshore bank. And Layla, really, as I say, didn't actually do anything terribly nonconformist. What she did was her job. She simply asked questions of her superiors about these CDs. They're getting 7 to 10% returns every year. How is that? Can I look at the portfolio? Why isn't there a bad year? What are they investing? How do they operate? And she asked one too many questions. And in 2002, she was simply fired and ended up having to pay back a large amount of that bonus and reach a settlement with the company. Now, a year later, in 2003, she writes a letter to the SEC in which she says, look, I just got fired from a company, and I suspect they're engaging in massive fraud. She actually said, this is a Ponzi scheme. And she said that in part because Houston, Texas, she had actually seen the Enron scandal. This was post-Enron. So she figured, okay, I'll alert the SEC. The regulators will do something. Why? Because this is America, and this is the U.S. financial system. And this is Wall Street. And in America, maybe in El Salvador, maybe in Mexico, maybe in other places where I've traveled and been, they allow this kind of corruption to go on. Here in the United States, they'll definitely stop it. No one answered Layla's letter. She sent the same letter to the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post and a couple of newspapers.
You know one mistake I think she made? She put the parts that she thought were most important in all caps.
That's true.
When I get a letter from somebody and large parts are in all caps, I'm like, I know this type of person, man.
Well, there's a fair point to be made about whistleblowers and if you read even very sympathetic accounts of whistleblowers, some of which I quote and cite in my book, you'll find that there is almost inevitably a kind of, what develops is a kind of, is someone out to get me? Is there some kind of conspiracy here? And claims that look exaggerated. And you're right, the bald caps in a sense would be, oh, well, there's a signal. This person is can't really be onto something. And indeed, I admit in the book that some of the people I interviewed, I interviewed two other Stanford whistleblowers who blew the whistle long after later. They figured out something was wrong at Stanford. And I heard their story. It all made perfect sense to me. And of course, the fraud that they suspected was going on was going on. Then it occurred to me as I walked out, I thought, you know, what if these guys had told me this story 2 years ago in a bar and told me all the terrible things this company was doing to them? I probably would have thought what one of their wives thought, which is they're crazy. You know, what is this story? This story is not credible. So there's this element of being, you know, finding it hard to believe that the person actually dissenting is actually onto something. Of course, Layla was onto something. It turned out that about 5.5 years after she sent that letter, she went through various other steps to try to alert the authorities. 5.5 years later, someone from the SEC finally does call her and says, Layla, we'd like to talk to you about a former employer of yours. And she sort of, you know, sighs and pauses and says, let me guess, Stanford? And, you know, the person from the SEC laughed, and I said, Layla, did you laugh? And she said, no, I wanted to scream. Which is understandable. But it also, I think, underscores what I hope the book brings across, which is that the questions that we think of as wartime dilemmas, as in these kind of extreme situations, do in fact surface in more prosaic contexts. The difficulty there is, in a sense, knowing, well, wait a minute, is this credible or is this person kind of... The more prosaic it is, the grayer the situation. In a sense, I think the higher the wall is in terms of getting other people to actually take it seriously, which is why I think whistleblowers often feel like they're talking to the wall and no one's listening to them.
Now, we said that she was different from the other three cases in that this was just corporate whistleblowing. She wasn't reaching across ethnic bounds or anything. Was she also kind of psychologically distinct in your view? I mean, by the same token, was she just... driven by a different kind of thing?
I think that she had very much, she fits in a classic way, this kind of true believer profile that I described. I didn't know what to expect, and I thought, you know, did she have a somewhat more, did she develop a more skeptical view of Wall Street, maybe of the financial industry, post Enron? And it is the case that Enron really shook her up. But Layla Weidler told me repeatedly, look, I really believed in our financial system, and I really believed in our regulators, and I believed that there couldn't be this kind of fraud. And in a sense, that naive belief propelled her to think, well, if I report this, if I, you know, exercise voice, people will hear it, and then something will be done. So in that sense, she's quite typical of the other people I write about. She also... you know, we talked a little bit about this distancing thing. And if we think about the Wall Street and the financial corruption that took place in Wall Street, by the time I was writing about that, having thought through the other cases in the book, it occurred to me, you know, it's very predictable. Because, of course, when you're selling a sketchy product to someone you never see, or to someone, you know, you just kind of, you're picking up the phone and this is all a game of numbers. How difficult is that, really, to just go along with? And Layla did have, again, she kind of made the mistake that Paul Gruninger made. She was very, very invested in the lives of her clients. She talked to them all the time. She befriended them. She was, you know, she's a very, she's that kind of person. She went all out for her clients. And so she imagined them getting this news. You know, you were my broker. You told me to buy these CDs. What's happened? Where are my savings now? And that thought kind of gripped her with fear. And that fear was greater than the fear of losing her job in the end.
Have you, no doubt, seen the movie Silkwood? Or you're right. I mean, you must have gotten pretty acquainted with that story. Any psychological commonalities between those? I'm not that familiar with the Silkwood story, actually. I haven't even seen the movie. But is there a commonality of profile between these two women?
I would have to, I've seen the movie, but it was years ago. I would have to see it again, and I know this, I know the rough outlines of the story. I did watch a number of Hollywood films of whistleblowers, in part out of fascination with, you know, inevitably in Hollywood, whistleblowers are heroes. You know, they're Russell Crowe in The Insider, or Al Pacino in Serpico. In the real world, and one of the most surprising sort of bits of data I came across that is in the book, is that Americans are actually less prone to say that a person should follow their conscience and disobey the boss than Europeans are.
Really?
Yes.
Survey data shows that?
Survey data.
That's funny, because we're supposed to be individualists, right?
That's right. And I figured, well, this form of dissent has a certain place in American popular culture, that we romanticize the kind of Thoreauvian impulse, the individual acting against the corrupted institution. But the sociologist Claude Fisher has looked at the data and, in a sense, argued or drawn from this that there were actually more conformists in this respect than most Europeans are. And I think what that speaks to is either that de Tocqueville was right, there is a sort of peculiar conformist impulse in American society and culture, or that we have a kind of deep ambivalence, almost schizophrenia, about this kind of thing. That on the one hand, it's the right thing to do, and we like to read about these cases of people, you know, of Jeffrey Wigand or Serpico going up against the corrupt institution. On the other hand, when it's our neighbor or our coworker or someone too close to us, we tend to distance ourselves very quickly. So that you know, speaks to, and maybe that tension is in every culture. I think it's more pronounced in the United States.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is what makes it courageous to do these things, I guess, but certainly, yeah, you can't expect vindication to come right away. I mean, that's part of the definition of these kinds of things. The Swiss police captain, he was punished for what he did in 1940, and then I guess it's several decades later they finally say, you know, on second thought, right thing.
He was actually officially exonerated and rehabilitated in 1993, which was 21 years after his death. So there were some acknowledgments in the 70s that he had done the right thing. He was, and some, you know, I think it was Yad Vashem that gave him an early acknowledgment, someone rescued. But it was not until 1993 that the Swiss government officially rehabilitated. And I tell that story in the book in part because, although this is a book about individuals, what interests me as much as the stories of the individuals in the book is the response of the society, in a sense, all the rest of us, you know, because it's not realistic to expect that everyone will do these kinds of things. We're talking about a minority here. But it is, in a sense, an open question how everyone else reacts. And in Switzerland, the reaction to Gruninger, not just in his day, but decades after the fact, were, let's cover it up, let's not bring this out, because it sheds such terrible light on, of course, everyone who not only went along, but in his case, Gruninger was also subjected to a smear campaign. There were rumors that he had done this for sexual favors, for money, that he had connections to the Gestapo. So all kinds of, in a sense, this was part of Switzerland's coming to terms with its own not-so-enlightened history during World War II. His case.
So, I mean, if you ask what, right now, say in America, what would a comparable act of conscience be? It can't be something that's obvious, right? I mean, the whole point of these things is that if you say, here's the right thing to do, most people right now would say, no, that's the wrong thing to do. So in other words, it has to be, all I can ask is for your own opinion, and you may have never thought of this, but I mean, are there issues that you think of where you really admire somebody for the stand they're taking, and you think maybe someday they'll be vindicated, but it's not easy to do now, or have you?
It's a very good question. I mean, I end the book with an interview with a military prosecutor who was sent to Guantanamo, who kind of went through underwent an an awakening and had an act of conscience and eventually testified on behalf of the defense for the detainee he had been asked to prosecute. This is Daryl Vandeveld, who at one point was the military prosecutor in 1 in 3 of the cases in Guantanamo. There are remarkable stories, and they're coming out now, I think slowly, of people in the U.S. military and in various capacities who did not go along with torture and abuse and various things that they felt were unconstitutional or un-American. So that would be, in a sense, one potential category. Another one that I thought of very much when I was writing the Gruninger chapter of the book, which is about refugees. And I don't want to give the impression that I think all these cases in the book are the same, that every moral dilemma is the same. Clearly not. Clearly there are extreme cases, there are more black and white cases, there are grayer cases, and so forth. But I was struck as I was reading that, that we also had a moral issue with refugees in the United States. And I'm referring to the translators and people in Iraq who helped the U.S. military and then, post-war, were, of course, the most endangered people in the country and were asking for visas to get out and were not being given them. There was some extraordinary reporting. George Packer wrote a long article about these people called Betrayed. And I came across that essay by Richard Holbrook because I heard Holbrook talk about rescuers during World War II at an event, and at that event, he specifically brought up the analogy with the people in Iraq who had helped the U.S. and were now in danger and were trying to get out, and no one was responding. So we do have these echoes in our society. They come up. I hope that the book isn't just seen as a book about moral dilemmas in distant, faraway places long ago in Rwanda or Yugoslavia or World War II, but rather that, in a sense, the message reverberates here.
Well, I think it does. I think the relevance is clear. It's a really excellent book, and congratulations on it. You know, it would make a good documentary. Three of the four case studies are people who are still alive, right?
That's correct. That is correct.
But you could actually go.
I do think that I will say this: the characters are not always easy to get along with, as I try to convey in the book. But they're also not boring. Their lives are not boring. Their ideas about the world are not boring. And when I say boring, maybe I should choose a different word: predictable. There's nothing predictable in the stories of these dissenters. These were people who they were the last people in a sense in the room who would have expected to do what they did, and maybe they themselves would have been the last person in that room to say they would have done it, because it so wasn't their type of thing.
Okay, well, I hope to see the documentary someday, and I hope sell the rights, make a lot of money, and use it good.
Okay.
So thanks for taking the time, Eyal, and good luck with the book.
Thanks so much for letting me do this.
My pleasure.